change the South?
Change the nation.
That's exactly what we do.
You're listening to low-wage fast food retail and home care workers who formed a new union in the South. It's called the Union of Southern Service Workers. Many of the members of the multi-generational effort are black women in the Carolinas, Georgia, and Alabama who are aging in jobs without a safety net. Let's look into the benefits of this kind of cross-sector organizing with Tina Vasquez, editor-at-large of the non-profit newsroom Prism. Tina, welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So you've been speaking with workers. Tell us more about the Union of Southern Service Workers. Who are they?
Well, it's interesting. It's sort of billing itself as the new union of the South. So it offers membership to low-wage service workers across the South. So as you mentioned, these are folks who do fast food jobs. They work in warehouses. It's a cross-sector union. It's very untraditional. It is part of the Service Employees International Union, but it's not really a union in the traditional sense because not only do members work in different industries and have different employers, so because of that, you're not really going to see things like union elections or, you know, efforts to unionize individual stores or company locations. This is really kind of a larger movement that's about giving workers the tools that they need to organize for higher wages, you know, and to have the support that they need to kind of hold their employers accountable if there are labor violations or if they need to strike.
And it's largely organized by black women. Tell me a little bit about that. Is that who largely makes up the workforce?
Yes. It's largely who makes up the workforce. And to me, what's particularly interesting about the Union of Southern Service Workers is that there's a very large focus on racial justice, not only because of the demographics of who's organizing, but as part of the kind of work that you see the union doing is political education. So there's a lot of work being done to help workers kind of understand the very strong connections between, you know, anti-black racism and anti-worker laws in the South.
And those anti-worker laws in the South include, you know, going back to Jim Crow, but include things like right to work laws, which they're really challenging strongly.
Yes. Yes. I mean, I would say that's one of the biggest challenges that these workers face is that they are organizing in right-to-work states, which doesn't make a union impossible, but, you know, there's a reason why these states have very low union membership, you know. So these laws bar union membership as a condition of employment, but they also have very, very racist roots. You know, they emerged in the 40s as a way to kind of keep wages low for African Americans, but also, you know, to stop various demographics of workers from organizing together, working together, like especially, you know, low-wage white and black workers. So there was this idea that allowing them to enter unions together, to do labor organizing together, would kind of upend the segregation that was imposed by Jim Crow laws that many people were invested in maintaining.
And state governments in the South have historically not been friendly to unions. We mentioned the right to work, which is kind of a bit of a misnomer because as you explained to us, what that means is that you're not allowed to join a union and you can't pay union fees automatically through your paycheck and things like that. What has been the local response to this union?
I mean, I think it's kind of a mixed bag. I think the pandemic really changed things. You know, during COVID, we've seen a real kind of wave of support for workers who are organizing for better conditions. But there are also, you know, really big challenges. As a reporter, I can't tell you how often I hear people say, you know, teenagers shouldn't get paid $15 to flip burgers. And I think those opinions are deeply, deeply entrenched. And I also think they come from a place of ignorance. You know, we know that many fast food workers are adults. They're often parents. And we also know that, you know, $15 an hour, according to lots of recent reports and studies, isn't even enough for people to feed their families or pay their rent in many places across the country. And so I think that's also going to be a really big challenge for this movement, is kind of disrupting those misconceptions about what unions are, what they do, and then who are the low-wage workers in the country and what are the kinds of circumstances that they're facing.
I want our listeners to hear from some of the workers that we're talking about. At part of a recent summit in South Carolina with hundreds of service workers, you can hear the excitement of these workers rallying together. Let's listen.
Ain't no power like the power of the union, because the power of the union don't stop.
And at this summit, Derek Bryant, a 28-year-old from Durham, North Carolina, took the mic to share how he joined the union after experiencing wage theft during a challenging time in his life.
I was homeless. I lost my grandmother, my nana, and I also lost my vehicle. I was excited when I got this job, you know what I'm saying? And I gave them my all, but I soon realized that they look for people like me to exploit me.
Tina, what else did you learn about Derek's story and what led him to joining the Service Workers Union?
Derek's story was really troubling. He was homeless and he was staying behind, I believe it was a Red Roof Inn. And the manager saw him and offered him a job and a place to stay at the hotel. And, you know, Derek thought it was such a blessing. But what he learned was that, as he said, they seek people like him out. So he was working 10, 12 hours a day, and his paycheck wasn't reflecting that. He was getting paid very little money for very few hours, even though they essentially treated him as if he was on call 24 hours a day. The room that they put him in was full of mold, and he wasn't the only employee there that experienced those conditions. He told me that he saw undocumented immigrants who were also experiencing the same, and it wasn't until he joined, you know, this union that he learned that much of what he experienced was illegal and that he experienced wage theft and that there should be ramifications for this kind of thing. But because so many workers don't know their rights, they don't know where to go or what to do when these kinds of things happen. And so that's another, I would say, key role that this union is playing, is that for the first time, workers are learning their rights and they're learning how to organize against these conditions.
So I'm curious how workers who maybe work in fast food came together with, you know, home care aides or, you know, they're very different work environments. How did they find each other to organize together or to join a union together?
You know, it's because this union is kind of an evolution of other movements. It started as the Fight for 15 and a Union, which is a national movement of low-wage workers who are fighting for increased wages. And North Carolina and the South had a very active branch called Raise Up. And these were workers of all kinds, many fast food workers, but also other folks in the service industry. And I think they saw a real need and a lot of power in being able to do that cross-sector organizing. Mm. And so then that kind of evolved into what we see today, which is the Union of Southern Service Workers. And the thing that they have in common is that they're all not being paid enough. They don't have benefits and their workplaces are very unsafe.
Why does it matter that this is happening specifically in the South? And what's the context to keep in mind here going forward?
The thing that workers tell me a lot who are part of this movement is that there are a lot of ideas about the South, right? Like primarily that it's backwards. And that's a really big point of contention for workers because so much innovative labor organizing is happening across the South, whether it's movements like this, like the Union of Southern Service Workers, whether it's migrant-led organizing, whether it's organizing that's happening with farm workers. I mean, you know, these perceptions of the South as backwards, as a person who lives in North Carolina and who reports on labor and immigration and all of these other issues, it's so strange to me because I see the kind of organizing that's emerging here and the effect that it has and the way that it's empowering people to change their workplaces or to improve their working conditions. It's really astounding. You know, so I do think the South is a place where there's a history of this kind of work, primarily that started with African Americans, and it's evolved and now it includes larger demographics of people, but it's really interesting and innovative, and it's not what a lot of people think of the South, but it is happening here.
And just finally, you know, one of the things that you mentioned is they're pushing for things like health benefits, you know, as it's an aging population of workers across these industries, they need health benefits as they get older. Do you think they'll be successful? I mean, it's hard to imagine McDonald's coming out with a benefits plan.
Yeah, I mean, I hope that they're successful. I feel like things are really hitting a breaking point, you know, between the lack of healthcare, the housing crisis, inflation. You know, the women I interviewed in my piece, Kumi Davis, and a very beloved figure in North Carolina named Mama Cookie, who organizes at her fast food establishment. These are women in their 60s who have no safety net. You know, they looked into retirement and they realized there was no way that they could afford it. They would get $700, $800 a month. Right now, they have to rely on charity care through hospitals. That is the only way that they have to access health care. And I mean, a lot of the workers just say, like, it has to change. There's no alternative. Like, we have to get what we need.
Tina Vasquez is editor-at-large at the nonprofit newsroom Prism. Tina, thank you so much.
Thank you.